nothing like getting the build up you can't live up to. First of all, can you hear me all right, or do I need to put on the microphone? I know sometimes that's more accessibility. Okay. If you do, just let me know. Thank you so much for having me today. And I am here in capacity of being thrilled to be working with the faculty at Dominican University. And actually, for my ILEAD folks, that's when I first became familiar with what Dominican was doing. And I think there's a great earned respect for Kate Merritt, Dean there, and the whole faculty. And so you may know that they're going through a really interesting growth and transition, adding information science programs as well as library science. And we've been talking about how do you retain that commitment and that pride in the field of librarianship and you bring in a new generation of folks who also then support librarians. You know, one of the things that we're working at South Carolina, that we're working on Dominican, is I think that, I'm all about world domination through librarianship, those who know me. And in order to do that, we need more recruits, right? We need to not only prepare great librarians for libraries, we need to prepare the mayors that oversee and hire them, and the principals who work with them, and the CIOs, and et cetera. And so I think it's a really amazing things that are going on there, and I'd be glad, I'm sure, to talk about that as well. So today, great future, right? This is a field, let's face it, as librarianship, we have some really wonderful and noble aspects to our field. Our dedication to looking at ourselves, constantly questioning what we're going to do, why we're here, what our worth is not, frankly, one of our more appealing things. I mean, it's important for any profession, any organization to look ahead and think where we're going, see where we're going. I think, however, that we, I don't know about you, but a future of libraries, sort of, you tend to go, again. And so I, when they said, Dave, come talk about the future of libraries, I said, really? And they said, yes. And they said, yes. I said, all right, but only if I can lie and not really talk about that. They said, fine. So where this title comes from and where this quote comes from is a fellow by the name of Alan Kay. And Alan Kay worked for Apple. He worked for IBM. Palo Alto Research Center Xerox. Before that, developing original GUI interfaces, really a pioneer in the field. And at one point, this is a lovely quote that he came up, which is the best way to predict the future is to invent it. Now, I am in the land of Lincoln. There's at least one person in there going, oh, like he said that, right? Yes, Lincoln also said something remarkably like that, which is the best way to predict your future is to create it. I like that too. These are good people to steal from, and so I do. But I love this concept. And so there is a field called futurism, and it looks at future trends, and it does a lot of analysis to try and figure out the future. I am not a futurist. I don't claim to be a futurist. I have actually very little interest in trying to predict the future. I'm sort of a currentist. I know that's not a word, but I'm going to continue to use it anyway, which is if we want a future, we better be very proactive in making sure that we create it. And so the message that I have, the message we're going to talk about, the message we're going to work on today is thinking about what do we want the future to be and how are we going to get there. So I want to split today up and give you a little break in the middle into two major parts. One is talking about a little bit of our history and a little bit of conceptualizing what is it that we do? What is it that's valuable? Sari Feldman just gave McCluskey lecture last night, Sari's a friend, and talked about Libraries Transform. And many of you probably have heard of the Libraries Transform campaign. What I thought was really fascinating is I'd always read that as us transforming other lives, and that's clearly one of the intentions. We transform people through our services, through engagement. We, help people have better parents, find jobs, find school, etc. But it also is the idea that libraries transform, that we are transforming as reaction to what our communities need. So I have to say, I have no connection to Illinois other than I lead you and start, that was like sort of the first time I started coming, and now I love every Illinois library because watching those teams, what you all did with I lead you is amazing. So I'll probably mention a couple of the projects there that you go, yeah, or you got that wrong. but one of them was a set of libraries that were working sort of in the O'Hare area, And the idea was that during the economic downturn, they wanted to provide services, right? People are laid off, they want to come in, they want to provide services. But rather than simply saying, we're going to help you do a resume, or we're going to help you do this, they said, this is really a point of transformation of your life, looking at what you want to be. Is it a matter of you lost your job, find me another one, right? That's sort of the immediate reaction. But is this a time that you actually want to go back to school? Is this a time where you want to talk about you were a dual-income family, could you make it as a one-income family? As well as the logistics of, all right, you don't have a steady income, what are the social services available? How do we get to college, et cetera? And to watch that team come together and say, when people hit any one of our libraries, it's not simply, oh yes, here's a job service. It was counseling and working with social workers, working with the local community, colleges and colleges, so that if you'd never heard of what a registrar was or a bursar, they can help you work through that whole process. That idea of transforming lives. That's a reaction to the world around it, right? It's a matter of saying, you know, we can keep throwing as much pleasure reading as we want at them, but if they're not in a state to even think about that, how can we begin to provide service? So we need to talk about what is that we do. And I think that's an ongoing conversation. So with that in mind, I want to talk about these two websites. I'm going to come back to it. I know you can't read it. I could put the lights. This is the debate between going to sleep or seeing the slides. So if you'd like me, I can. Let's try.
Are you
sleepy? Is that all right? Okay. I teach undergraduates too, so you know. It's 9:40, which means it's happy hour, probably where they are. Okay, so I want to talk about these two websites, because these two websites, and you know, don't have to mask them. One is Topeka, Kansas, and one is Richland County Public Library in South Carolina. To me, these two websites demonstrate a fundamental shift in how we think about librarianship. How many are in the public library sector? So most of you. Any academics hanging around? Schools? And you're, all right, there's. We wish more of them were in school, right? I won't go into that. All right, so I want to talk to you about why it does relate to academic libraries, but why I think this is a fundamental shift. These are their strategic plans, and I'm going to go through them in a bit of detail later. But this is a real change. And so I want to walk you through that change and why it's important. And I'm going to start with some statements that I doubt many of us would question. Many of us would say, sure, right? So here's one. The more data, the better decisions. This is a sort of interesting argument that you hear all the time. If we could just get more stuff, people will make better decisions. And if you haven't heard this, and if you don't even see this in library land, clearly, this is a narrative that is winning the day, if you will, around society, right? Between our buddies, Facebook and Google, right? These are billion-dollar companies that are based on data. They're based not just on the idea of providing out search results, but analyzing where you went, how you went, what you looked at, who you looked at, selling your privacy, fun things like that. This concept is really now the major narrative. And going back to the idea of information schools for a moment, if you go look at your alums, I'm guessing without spending too much time, you can probably find a faculty member or something talking about data science or data mining, right? It's the big new hot topic, right? So no one's hiring, you know, old geezers like me. They're all hiring the young punks in data mining, which is really statistics, but I won't go there. Anyway, right, so this is the concept. Get more data. If we have more data, we can make better decisions. In the corporate world, call it analytics, but it's the idea if we have more data, we can do it. Sari Feldman at dinner was talking about the importance of analytics. When we go out for the bond issue, we want to know what the sentiment is, how many times they use it, what's the profile they use it, right? You've probably seen this in your own libraries. It's going from, all right, we have circulation data, can we break that down even finer to, turns out these kind of folks like these kind of materials, this is a growth area, et cetera. We're looking at statistics. In Philadelphia, there is a project called CityStat. And the idea was to take all the statistics from the different city agencies, including the libraries, and begin to create GIS maps so they could do analysis. So they found, for example, that, not districts, but areas, neighborhoods, that have public library branches in them had a lower crime rate. Now, that's interesting, right? And trust me that many of us would run and say, save the world, build libraries. It also turns out that many public libraries are located very near police headquarters. And being in South Carolina, where we have a slight awareness of the color of our skin on a regular basis, it turns out that a lot of library branches are in places that don't have crime, they're in more affluent areas, right? And getting libraries in lower economic strata, getting them in challenging neighborhoods is a tough sell. And so that kind of data is great, but that kind of data can be misleading, right? The old line about statistics are like a lamppost. You either use it to enlighten you or to lean against, right? We've seen that. There's a company, Welch Allen, in the upstate New York area. They make, if you've ever gone to the doctor, they put that cuff and they press that button and they shove that thermometer, they make that machine, right? And they make lots of those machines. If you walk through your doctor's office, you see Welch Allen. Well, the thing is, they sort of tapped that market. It turns out there are only so many doctors. So they're looking for what the next market is. And the next market, and I love this phrase, and I use it all the time, is the worried well. The worried well are people who are just fine, but are worried that they want to remain just fine. So how many of us have device, whatever, that tells us how many steps we did, right? Yep, Fitbit, cell phone, etc., Apple Watch. Yeah, right. And we walk around and it says, congratulations, you've stood out. And I'm like, that's Steve Jobs is a genius. I made 10,000 steps. Is that good? I don't know. I had a competition going with my good friend Jill Herswall, and I discovered a couple of things. You may well use these. One, if you're on a riding mower, it still counts as steps. but the best one is, get into an elevator and you walk, pace around the elevator, it counts as stairs. And see, you thought I'm coming, it's going to be a waste of day. I'm giving you tips. But is it Brigham Young University? Actually, their PE department, they issued these to all of their students so that they have a mandatory sort of physical exercise requirement. And, you know, you sit there and you go, all right, I know they may be Mormons, but really, they're sitting walking in a bunch of elevators, too. So data is clearly how we make better decisions. This is truth. This is how it works. Except, of course, it doesn't. Right? It's not a causal relationship. I can't just load you full of data and assume you'll make a better decision. And we just gave a few examples about how you can cheat the system or how you can misinterpret the statistics. But this is my favorite data story, so I've used it before, I apologize if you've heard it. Target does data mining, right? Retail data mining. Who are you? Did you get our coupon? Did you use the coupon? Did you read, by the way, if you get an email from Target and you simply open to see what it is, it's embedded so it will communicate that you saw the ad, right? You didn't know it was doing it, but that's what it's doing. That's why you get lovely HTML formatted emails these days is because they have cookies in them that send them off, right? So Target uses data a lot, right? One thing that Target realized by looking through that data is it turns out that there are a few crucial times in a woman's life where she will radically change or potentially change her shopping behavior, right? When you get married, right? When you retire, etc. But the one that they found the sort of biggest sweet spot was when women get pregnant, they tend to change their shopping, right? I'm not going to Walmart anymore. I'm going to get the organic stuff at, right? I'm going to suddenly, they change, it becomes, they buy vitamins, and they're worried about what kind of vitamins, and they're worried about diapers. And they would see what's the diaper commercial, right? The first parent is like, we all went out and bought the most expensive diapers, and the second parents are like, shrink wrapping their kids, and they're like, the best. But so Target realized this. And so Target did a huge amount of work to focus on knowing when a woman was pregnant and then deluging them with ads because they found out that's when they can shift this. And turns out once you shift, you stay shifted. In other words, if you suddenly went from shopping at Kmart and Walmart to suddenly shopping at Target, you tend to stay at Target. So the story goes that they did this data so well that they could sometimes predict at a very early point in a woman's pregnancy when she was pregnant. And so what happened was this one
girl was pregnant, and they had the data, and they started sending all this email about diapers, about nutrition, all this kid stuff. And the father saw this woman's email. I'm just livid. Why are you promoting pregnancy to my teenage daughter? Why are you pushing these things? And complained to the manager. It turns out the daughter was pregnant and hadn't told her father. Right? So, you know, here's your coupon, you know, here's the cake, whether it's blue or pink, and here's alienation from your parents for the rest of your life. So this kind of use of data, do we believe that that's better decisions? From Target, that's clearly a better decision. It worked. But at a larger scale, is that where we want to be? Right? In universities, we're dealing with this on a regular basis. I talked to a bunch of undergraduates, they were juniors, and I said, all right, I'm going to lower your tuition bill. I'm going to cut your tuition bill in half. And the way I'm going to do it is you already have an ID, and I'm going to put an RFID chip in that ID. And I'm going to know what you eat. I'm going to know who you're eating with. I'm going to know where you are. I'm going to know when you come home, when you leave, who you're with when you do it. I'm going to see what you shop for at the bookstore. I'm going to see what you eat on your meal plan, the whole thing. And I'm going to take it, I'm going to sell it. And that revenue is going to decrease your tuition. And to a point, they all said, decrease my tuition. We have this sense that youth these days, the kids these days in their face tubes, that they're just giving it away. They don't get it. They're not smart enough. They're really, you know, throwing caution to the wind, etc. But actually, they do get it. The study after study shows that teenagers in particular see their privacy and their personal information as a commodity and a value equation. They know they're surrendering part to get a given capability. It's actually we folks that don't quite get the fact that when we get on Facebook, we are the problem. Right? They do. And so, once again, are we happy with this? Are we comfortable? Data makes better decisions. I don't think we buy it. So this might be a better way of saying it. The better the information, the better the decision. Right? Information is not just data. It is contextualized. It makes sense. It is given a context. It is brought together. And so the idea here now is, see if I can bring this back up, right? That we are in the information business. We're not in the data business. Now, this became very clear to me in a rather abstract way. I had a doctoral student from the former Soviet Union. He just defended his dissertation. What's today? He defended on Tuesday. He did a great study, and he looked at the Soviet system of science and technical information to the American system of science and technical information and how the evolution occurred. The Soviet style was very centralized and controlled. The American system was very distributed, blah, blah, blah. But he did what I think a lot of us do, which is he kept talking about the explosion of information. Well, we have an explosion of data. We have lots of data. We have more data than we ever knew what to do with. But we haven't necessarily got an explosion of information because that makes sense to people, right? It's how much they can interpret, how much they can read, documents. We've taken the time to massage it. We worry about its validity. We worry about its origin. We worry about lots of different things that we have. So clearly, the better the information we're giving out, not just saying, here's a bunch of statistics, good luck. It's now saying, here's why it matters to you. Here's how it's happening, right? So clearly, we're not in the data business, we're in the information business. We're all about helping people make sense of things, bringing it into their lives, and connecting it. And so the question becomes, is that information contextualized, it's curated, it's selected, and it's networked, right? This is a different concept. When we looked at libraries as big data, when we looked at libraries' job to get it all, that was one thing. We don't look at it that way anymore, right? We look at it getting the right stuff. We weed. We weed on a regular basis. We do it late at night when no one's watching, but we weed. Right? We know we can't buy every book, every material, so we have a selection policy, criteria, and profiles, and all of this. So this changed our concept of we're the everything place to we're the information place. We're the place where you come to be informed. And so this is now where we sit, right? We're pushing to this different sectors in places like education and health. We've seen this not only in our libraries, but we see it in our library schools. So the University of South Carolina is now a library and information science program. Right? You see this in places like Emporia, right? They're in the information business. We just talked about it, Dominican. There are information studies, right? This migration forward. By the way, not as an abandonment to libraries, but trying to be better articulating what libraries do. Right? I think there's an understandable tension when university, when library science programs change their name. Right? When the library drops out, I think there's an understandable tension, worry, that what that means is they're devaluing the institutions. I think another way to think about it, and by the way, keep everyone honest about it, is that it really is now an emphasis on what they do and much less on where they do it. Which, if that sounds familiar, it's because what we're preaching within libraries as well. We're getting out of the idea that it has to be in this building or has to be over here. Right? We have meeting. This meeting space is not so that we could build a bunch of cubicles for librarians so the community could come in and we could go out. I lead cubicle projects, right? The idea of, do I have anyone here that was doing the hotspot loaning program? Right? Very cool. That idea that we can bring the library to you, we can bring the resources, and what the iLeadU project that was doing it was, they were showing up at soccer games with the hotspots. And it wasn't, they didn't have a nice thing going, come learn what a hotspot was. They just set up the hotspot, and actually all the bored parents who were tired of watching the six-year-old move in some sort of amoeba-like fashion around the ball or pick their nose while watching flowers could suddenly find that, oh, I have Wi-Fi. This is much more interesting. Yes, I'm watching, hon. Right? That idea that we could get out there, we could be in the community, is that same thing that we're seeing here, which is, it's not just what happens in libraries, it's preparing librarians to affect communities wherever that community is, the out there in the world. And we see this not only in library science land, we see this in every industry, which is every industry is becoming an information field. Right? If you, how many people have gone to a doctor in the past 5 years? All right, that's a personal health information. I won't watch the answer. Right? How many people have glasses that have gone to an optometrist in the last 5 years? Dentist? Do you have a patient portal for all three of those like I do?
Nope.
Why? Right? I have to remember my login to find out if I can see. And then I'll log in to get rid of this pain, and then maybe I'll get my blood pressure results. I mean, I went through cancer treatment, and I at one point I counted up, I had 10 different doctors, and I had 10 different systems to find out. I'm like, I'm going to die just because someone checked. Death by password loss. I mean, that's going to be the next case out there. But what's happening is that there's a change in how medical professionals, patient-centered care, et cetera, it's not about curing the sick, it's about preserving health, right? And it's back to this, right? So is it Aetna? One of the insurance companies, they're talking about actually getting everyone an Apple Watch so that it will keep track of fitness and data and heart rate, and that will create more data on affecting premiums, things of that nature. So we're seeing this all the time, contextualized, network, it's changing the world. But once again, not always true, right? I mean, one could hardly argue that we live in a time where we don't have enough information about the presidential election. Right? I'm not going to take a political stand. I think the choice is obvious. But right, this is a situation where what we have is a lot of information, a lot of contextualized, in fact, contextualized to the point of a bubble, where it's contextualized, linked, and networked to such a degree that we can connect to a specific way of thinking about the world. We can emphasize a different way of thinking about it, right? It's not that everyone thinks that, yes, I love misogyny and racism, that's where I want to go, but if you are this demographic, I can talk to you about the economic situation and what it means for jobs, right? This is the same thing happening over here. Who do we talk to? How do we get out there? What's the ground game? We are awash in information. So once again, simply providing even contextualized data more and more out to people is still not necessarily effective. Right? We're not quite to the point where this is our future. This is very much seen as our moment. But very much seen as our future that we got in the information game. Once again, I'll refer to Sari's talk last night. Remember, many of you don't because you look all way too young. And I mean all, really. When the internet was going to put libraries out of business, right? The internet's here, we don't need it, we've got it. And now we've no, there's too much information. You need us to manage it, to help you through it, to provide facilitation. Right? So, but this concept is, that's where we are now. We're pushing out information. We'll inform you. We'll help you make decisions. You're going to change jobs. You're going to visit Florence. You have a healthcare coming up, a procedure coming up. You looking for a good book, whatever it is. We're here to contextualize that information. We're networked where it is. We are here to help. Right. So this is a really sort of current view of the field. But then we can move to, all right, it's not just informing. Because informing is the worst passive-active verb I know, right? To inform someone. What does that mean? Right? I backed up, I killed your cat, thought you were like, no, I'm leaving, right? I left it on a voicemail, so I didn't actually talk to you. Right? What does it mean to be informed? What does it mean to be giving information? But that's where we are. If you still look at a lot of how we assess and evaluate libraries, it's much more about what we pump out than the impact of once we pump it out. Right, we look at circulation data. We don't look at readership data. Right, we all have those folks who come in and check out 5 books and return them the next week. Now, some of them can read 5 books in a week, but some of them were shopping, and they said, ah, we'll see. Right? But we don't know that. By the way, Adobe does. Because we gave them a nice little system that sends back exactly what they read. Overdrive does. But we don't. And so that idea of simply pumping out and pushing information is insufficient as well. It's what we do in changing how people see the world and how they understand and can cope with the world. It's how they learn that matters, right? It's the more knowledgeable you are, the better decisions you can make. It's not a matter of your access. You know that plenty of people have plenty of money and plenty of access and plenty of connections and plenty of whatever to get whatever information they want, and they still make stupid decisions. They don't look. They don't care. They don't know. I have a Darren Freeberg, is faculty member at South Carolina, brilliant, and he looks at knowledge management. And so I'm used to this phrase of knowledge management being very corporate, going into IBM and Siemens and Boeing and saying, all right, how do we manage our knowledge? How do we make better decisions? He looks at churches, and he said for many people, the knowledge, where they learn about their communities and understanding and reacting to the communities, is actually a Sunday sermon. And so he looks at sermons as a way of doing knowledge. What nice thing. Right? What is it? How does this influence how you think about a given issue, a given voting, what's going on, what's occurring? Right? Knowledge management. How do they understand it? One of the things that he knows is that many small groups, when you form these ministries and outreach, they have lots of access. But what happens is it quickly turns into a bunch of like-minded people making a decision and sticking with it. And so the idea being that, yes, you have access to knowledge, you just don't get it. You just don't want, I don't mean go get it. I mean you don't go out and get it because you don't even think it's important. And part of what he just wrote a great grant, which is information literacy for these small groups. How can we go in and train them in seeking out information, the importance, the validity of the information, and would that change their behavior? So it's about what they know. And we know, the more you know, the better your decisions you can make. And this is where I sort of ended up. So I wrote a couple of books, et cetera, one of which is This Expect More. And really, that's what it ended up, which is we're in the knowledge business. And the knowledge is conversation, and we're in the conversation business. Right? All this wonderful stuff. I'm happy to talk to you about it. But that's where I ended, which is we're worried about how people learn. Right? It's not that how many kids came to your school library on Thursday. It's how many of those kids improved their performance based on that visit. Back to my academic library book. Right? The idea is that we are going to get accredited. What institution of higher education?
National University of Health Sciences.
Perfect. So the National Institute of Health Sciences, on a regular basis, gets accredited. Right? We have a firm that comes in and says, did you do your job? And the job used to be, how many students did you get in, how many graduated, on what time. But now it's, what were they supposed to learn, and how can you prove that they learned it, and by the way, a grade doesn't count. Because we know
And I'm certain no one in this room has ever gotten an A because they've had a professor like me that's like, yeah, fine. How many people have gotten an A because it's like, oh, it doesn't matter. And so what we really want to know is, do they know the outcome? And so what's another ILEADU project, but also something going on, is the idea of, can we actually mine the data of the resources they looked at, what they looked at, privacy in there, so sort of working on the idea of amalgamating, of aggregating data. Could we actually say that students who go to the library, the academic library, do better in their courses? I mean, that's a pretty powerful thing to say. Now, I want to be clear, back to the very beginning. We actually have that data for school libraries. We actually have really good data, really good studies that say an active, engaged school library media project, not just a room with books, but a librarian who's active and engaged increases student performance on standardized testing. That is an amazing nugget of information that has in no way helped as people have come / school libraries. So it's not enough to simply say, we have the data. We have to understand how we use that data. But that's where this sits. And what I want to talk about now is the next step. Going, oh great, Dave, another book. Probably, but not there. The next step is, this is still rather passive. Knowledgeable people don't improve society. Engaged communities that share their knowledge improve. Just having someone who's smart, just having someone who reads a lot, just having someone who consumes information, just having someone who spends the time doing analysis doesn't make a difference unless they are moved to action. Same thing for a library. Just having a building full of capability, right? If you think about it, this is a library is a potential. It's a community potential. It isn't until we open the doors, bring the folks in, send the librarians out, launch the web servers, that we actually talk about whether there's value to that potential, whether it's realized. And so we can be helping lots of people learn and improve, et cetera, but if they learn and don't do anything about it, if we learn and don't share it, if they learn and don't engage, then ultimately our impact is null. So that brings me then to these two websites. Because these two institutions, I think, are at the beginning of the next wave, right? So wave one, all about the data. Big buildings, lots of phone books from all around the country from 1972. You want it, you get it. The Katharine Hepburn model of librarian. I actually now have library students who have never seen Death Set, and I just think that's unacceptable. So we're gonna have to build it into the introductory course. And you're sitting there going, Death Set. Just nod and say that's good. All right. Oh, people shut up. Great. Wave one. We got the stuff. We are the collectors and managers. Wave two. It's not just data, it's knowledge. So now we have organization and we curate it, we provide reference services, we provide instructional classes. Wave three. We're all about assessing and making sure you're learning it. So those classes aren't just these kinds of things, but we sit down and work with you, tutoring services, et cetera. And now what's the next wave? What are we looking at moving to? And these are two examples. And I'm going to start with Kansas. Gina Millsap's shop. Gina Millsap lives in Kansas, so I won't make too many political statements, but here's one. Kansas doesn't have a state government. It's much like Illinois. Where state government is kind of like the badge on the hood of your car. It's really not helping you go anywhere, but you gotta have it. Maybe. Right? So there is, I think, a deliberate attempt to not have functioning state government. I mean, it really is a philosophical attempt of going about what's the role. So really, as Gina points out, the only functional government in Topeka is the library. It's a government agency, and she's very proud and says on a regular basis, we are the government. We are part of the government. And so they began looking around and coming up with their strategic plan and saying, what do we do next? Now, as a strategic plan, we're all used to them. What's our strengths? What's our weaknesses? Where do we want to go? What's our five-year outlook, et cetera? We'll get to that in a bit. But they started saying, what do we really want our communities to do? And they started working with United Way
They started working with philanthropy, and they started talking about impact.
And what they came up with is, we want to have this impact on our community. We want every child to be ready for kindergarten. We want everyone to discover their passion for learning. We want everyone to continue new ways to live their best life. Topeka and Shawnee County will be engaged in community readers. The library will be a learning organization committed to excellence in leadership, planning, customer focus. Now, those don't sound particularly, you know, yay, we want people to read. How revolutionary. I get that. But what's cool is take that first one. Every child will be ready for kindergarten. They're a public library, but they're putting their hat in the ring of public education as well. They say, we're going to help improve education. That's one. The other thing that they've done is they say, we can't do it on our own. So the schools have to be here, and the tutoring services have to be here, and the literacy organization. And the transportation industry has to be there. And the United Way has to be there. And food has to be there. And so these are hooks to connect. And the way they developed them is they had a series of town hall meetings around their entire service area with the United Way, with these organizations, and said, what do we need? And that's where they came to kindergarten. It turns out that if people are not at reading level by third grade, they will never achieve reading level parity again, and their chances of success, including graduation of high school, greatly diminish. We know that reading at third grade is an instrumental point of evaluation. And it's not just whether they get through school, it's the jobs they get, their annual income, their earnings. So that may look like, isn't that nice, but what that is if we want to have a workforce that's ready to go, we have to be ready to go. Boeing Corporation. South Carolina, it's lovely moving from New York to South Carolina because the world is a different place. And one thing that South Carolina has gotten really, really good at is coming and swiping industry. You're welcome. So I believe you guys felt a little Boeing moving out of the way. Kansas and Washington are not happy. And I was actually in Syracuse. Syracuse Carrier Corporation, Carrier Dome in Syracuse, used to make all their air conditioning in Syracuse. They moved it all to South Carolina. Why? Taxes. Taxes, incentives, whatever you want. So Boeing sets up. They're all ready to go. And Boeing is doing manufacturing. But manufacturing is fundamentally different than the way it used to be. It's no more people pressing buttons and pulling down drill presses. It's working with and programming robotic systems. It's dealing with microcircuitry. It's dealing with quality control mechanisms and workflows, etc. And so they go to start hiring people for their brand new factory, and they found out that they didn't have a prepared workforce. So what do? They began investing lots of money in STEM programs, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, at the high school level. Let's fund lots of science and technology curriculum. And they found out it didn't help. Why? Because no one could read by the money in high school. So now they're talking about third grade literacy, reading levels. That idea that's the building. Their long-term strategy-driven capitalist scheme of building a workforce to go and rule the world is third grade literacy, because they have that long a view about workforce development. When we say ready for kindergarten, this isn't just because libraries like reading stuff. It's an economic discussion. It's a philanthropy discussion. It's a taking care of your parents discussion. It's a whole thing. So this is one example, but let me show you sort of a little bit more clear example. This is the strategic plan from the Richland County Public Library, and they have several goals. Goal number one, help create a strong and resilient economy. It's nice to have us here. We are viewed as valued partners to elected officials and business leaders in support of economic and community development. We help grow and support creative individuals and communities within the county. Library Facility Improvement Service, catalyst for greater investment in neighborhoods and increased opportunities for residents. Job seekers and entrepreneurs see the library as a vital to their employment, career, and business development aspiration. This did not come from a bunch of librarians sitting in the main branch going, I have a good idea. Once again, this happened by meeting with the sheriff's office, meeting with town hall, county government, meeting with local community groups, local community agencies, and it's their goal as much as it is the library's goal. These was developed in a proactive process that did not say, what do you want the library? That's never the right question. How can the library help? What can the library do better? They don't know, and it's your job, not theirs, to figure it out. What you want to ask is, what do you want to be when you grow up? Where do you want to go? What can we be? What can we do? And so they said, we need to help create a strong and resilient economy. Goal number two, strengthen community cohesion. There are an increased number of opportunities for diverse groups of people to converse, communicate, and learn together. Neighborhoods recognize and celebrate their assets and strengthen their identities. Public, nonprofit, and private sectors convene at the library in an effort to solve community problems. Now here's another one that's interesting. Because once again, this came out of a real awakening. This came after, if you may recall, about a year and a half ago, shootings at a Charleston black church. That changed South Carolina's view. It really did. I mean, I'm a newcomer, but even I can see it. What suddenly it was, we can't say racism's fine because it doesn't hurt anymore. It suddenly became, we can't just take the invisible structures of racism and pretend they're not there. This is what turned into taking the Confederate flag down from the Capitol, down from its monument, and now it's sitting in a box somewhere because someday there might be a museum. That changed. It changed the dialogue at the University of South Carolina. We now have someone in the provost's office whose specific area is diversity and working with diversity. Right? It changed that conversation. And what the library is saying here is we need to be part of that conversation. And not just about really the heavy topic. Sorry to bring the really heavy stuff here voluntarily. But it's also, they began training their librarians as facilitators. And what that meant was, they started with their youth librarians. They trained them in diagnosing and working with children with dyslexia. They identified that as a need. And what they began doing, offering workshops, offering programs. What they talked about is they would get a huge homeschool population that would come into the library, they would come to a workshop on dyslexia, they would come to them afterwards and go, thank you. They said, I pulled my kid out of school because he wasn't performing, or she wasn't performing, because I thought the schools were failing. And then I couldn't get them to read, and I thought, I was failing. And in tears, the parent would say, I now know what I can do to help my That happened because librarians said our job is not simply hear the books, hear the materials. What we have to worry about are, can they read them? Can they make sense? They had to go to impact. They had to go to making a change. They're working now with facilitators so that they are going to have countywide charrettes, design things, design competitions around things like we have this lovely lake that every thousand year floods, but a lovely river, sorry, that goes through downtown. And in many cities, unlike Chicago, though Chicago used to turn its back on its lake or its river, now they build towards it, we turn our back on our river. How do we develop it? The librarians are going to bring in economic development people with monies and grants, design architects, community people, form them into teams, work with them over a day to design ideas as part of the competition. Literally facilitators of how they can do it. And that's where they're going to start and they're going to keep going. Transform educational outcomes for youth. The level of access to high-quality out-of-school time opportunities increases. Parents and caregivers have the knowledge and support necessary to help their children be successful in school. Partnerships and services that support the path from high school to career in colleges are strengthened. Working with us on a regular basis. So another I Lead You project, if anyone's here, the one on working between Project Mystic. Working with school librarians and public librarians. They realized that they sort of were in the same area, had the same talk, but never met, never talked to each other. So they came together and they came together in a social event. One night a month, they would have dinner together. And they talked about what cool things they could do. The first thing they came up with was teacher checkout. The teacher checkout was the teacher could identify the materials they would need. The library would compile them, and after school, the teacher could just literally walk in, pull up the bin, and walk out without having, you know, any time wasted. I thought they should go one more step, which is that you could check out a teacher. If I have any parents here who have had to try and help their kids do fourth grade mathematics, you know what I mean.
What's 4 divided by 2?
2.
Yeah, but how do you know that? Because it's 2. Yeah, but how does that work on the number line? I don't know. It's 2. What's happening with mathematics education, I was so thrilled I walked into my high school kids' class in algebra and they had the FOIL method. I'm like, I know FOIL. First hour and last. I got that. But, you know, they know that, for example, number theory says that by being able to visualize quantities, work with information, people retain mathematics in a much better way, whereas I memorize 4 divided by 2 is 2. Right? And so that whole thing about being able to work with the instructors, teach them, that's the kind of thing that we can do. Help, but I love this one.
I love this one.
Help break the cycle of poverty. Learning outcomes and access to educational opportunities to those living in poverty in Richland County are increased. Partnerships with service providers are created and strengthened, eliminating barriers for those customers
with specific basic needs.
Once again, this wasn't a bunch of librarians sitting in an office going, this is a good idea. This was the sheriff's office saying, this is how we handle the homeless, can we do it better? The shelters who were saying, this is how we can coordinate and work with you. This was all the groups coming together to be a part of this. And so this is much more a mission strategic plan for the community as much as it is for the library. Now, by the way, other goals in the strategic plan include things like how we're going to do our development and our budgeting and very library-specific stuff, but this is a strong part.
And so one of the questions is, do you, when you're developing your strategic plan or you're planning for libraries, what's your community plan? How much of the community is involved in developing that plan? What are the mechanisms that you can get the mayors to contribute, the county officials to contribute, the local universities to contribute, the sheriff's office? How wide is your strategic planning process? Who are the people in the room? And then the next question becomes, what commitment did they have to make that happen? Just, it's great to say we're all going to be about ending poverty. It's another thing to say, this is what I'm going to do. Are you going to do this? How do we match that money back together? Real money, real time, real thing.
So this is where I think we're going. We need to think about impact over thinking about output. Outcomes, for those in the assessment world, is getting closer, but really it's that impact. Tell the stories. We know that the most powerful stories in budget time are having someone stand up and say, I learned to read. I got a job because. What's that impact? Can we quantify it? Can we qualify it? Can we describe it? Kim Soap in Canada did a great study on the economic impact of the Toronto Public Library to the city of Toronto. $5, or I think it was even $10 for every dollar invested, etc. She has a great line. She goes, data makes story real, stories make data matter. You need both of them together, right? And so we need to do that. Think community first, institution second. When you're putting together strategic plans, when you're putting together project plans, when you're putting together the next phase, the new program, think community first, institution second. Who in the community, individuals, part of organizations, and then form cross-type working groups. Spend a lot of time in each other's shops. Develop profiles of success, and ultimately talk about community-wide strategic planning. All right. Questions, thoughts, arguments, disagreements? Examples. Who's doing some of this? What are you doing?
You want a project or you want the concept in our strategic plan? Well, I'll just take one example on our strategic plan. We have community table, and that's either we're at the table or we are the table for community
transportation. Oh, I like that. We are the table. I have one other phrase, which is if you're not at the table, you're usually being served on top of it. Other thoughts, other ideas, other examples where you've seen this kind of thing work? Please.
We're just working on a community engagement plan and really having it more be, it just seems that if you build it, they will come, but I think we've come to the realization that we as an organization have to go out, that we have to look at the community needs and think of different ways of serving them because their needs have changed. We're in a rather more affluent community, so sure. The needs are very different. You can't say, you can't align and say, oh, well, we've helped reading, but we or test scores. Well, maybe we have, but I don't know if the statistics or the data is
sure.
There, so. And we're also, I like a phrase, it's data-rich information poor.
That's a good
so
one.
We got lots of that.
We got lots of data. Don't necessarily know how to interpret and make sense of it. Yeah. Other thoughts? All right. Phase two. How do we begin doing this kind of planning? Do we want to jump into it, or would you like a small break? Break? All right. Let's come back at 10:30. This gives you a chance to escape and buy tickets. And yeah. All right. You've had a chance to caffeinate. Thoughts, questions, comments from before? Things you were talking to your friends about? Oh, he's so wrong. And then didn't want to bring that up?
I guess it all sounds great, but it's like putting it into practice. That's
the
difficult part, because it all sounds wonderful.
Right. How do you make it happen?
How do you make it happen?
What a great transition. All right, I'm keeping the lights up this time. Tell me if you want to change it. All right, how do we make it happen? All right, so as I started with, that beginning was where I think our future lies. Our past was big data, our future is big impact, right? Our past was collections of information, our future is communities as collections. We'll talk more about the details. But so that's the argument. But then the question becomes exactly that. How do we do it? So for my next trip, what I want to talk about is creating an agenda. Not specifically around communities, but if you're trying to put an idea in place, if you're trying to get something out there to get people to think about, how do we do this? And really, it's that idea that I'm not trying to predict the future. I really want to talk about how we can begin to invent that future. And so the way to think about it is we all get pretty good at describing our present situation, sometimes way too good, and spend way too much time discussing what's happening now. But take a thought, take an idea. Community involvement, hotspot loaner programs, community-based strategic planning, coming out with developing outcomes, etc. Think about that area that you want to have an impact. A new idea. I want greater reference. I want to try something new. I have a project that I want to put in place. And think about what's like that. So I'll give you an example. I had a student, who worked at St. Louis County Public Library, and she was very interested in the idea of learning in libraries. Very interested in early learning in libraries, youth, etc. And when she looked around at the kind of projects and the kinds of things that were happening in her library and the libraries she saw, she found it very inadequate what was occurring. That what libraries were doing, story time was great, but still can be somewhat passive, the idea of some of the tutoring or learning was very traditional, very like this. And she wanted to have this sort of a more engaged way of learning and working with the libraries. So the idea was that she wanted people to, I mean, we've all heard the phrase, she wanted to have people learn, kids, learn through play. Right? That they wanted to be engaged, they were active. So that was her idea. And she began with the idea of the present. Jennifer Alardi was and it was the idea that, all right now, my library, the libraries I see, the libraries I interact with, not doing a great job, but a sense of at least the current situation, but they're doing something. So clearly I don't have to sell them on the idea that libraries are about learning, they're doing it, but it's not necessarily taking in the latest pedagogy. So a description of the present. Maybe it's, we need to do more community-based planning, our current situation is we get the library administration, does retreats 3 times a year, comes back, we have a vision. I would much rather to whatever it is. Then what you want to be able to do is predict if nothing else changed, if we did nothing, if I did nothing, what do I think this would end up as? What's my anticipated future? We'd never try it, we'd do more of these things but not have a community impact, or our library funding is getting cut, it's not going to go up, we don't have enough collaboration with schools, there's nothing that's really going to force us to.
some predictive future. Now, as an academic, many of my ilk think this is our job, right? Through methodologies, through research, through data, we want to anticipate what's going on. We come up with theories and predictions and models. You can even say this is very much what Target was into, right? If you have these kinds of buying habits, this will be your future buying habits, right? Target sort of gave up on, you know, 15-year-olds to Abercrombie and Fitch. They wanted to get to 35-year-olds, right? So, you know, that idea of where are we, where do you want to go? You can't stop here, though. This is where futurism really, for me, breaks down. This is where I get very frustrated, is that I see people, and they cite the data, they cite the statistics. I can't fault them for what they're doing, but it's a passive view of the future. This is what's going to happen. Libraries will get bigger, get smaller, etc. We will be more relevant, not relevant, etc. Right. This was the internet will make libraries obsolete because they define libraries in a certain way. It said if it keeps happening that way, everything's online, then we'll go there. I remember I taught, I was there. Meaning I was alive. When the web first happened. Right? We built one of the first 100 websites. It was great. And the argument that libraries made is libraries are still relevant in an age of the web because not everything can be online. Right? That was the argument. The argument was there's some things that will never digitize, never be online. It was a stuff-based argument. The value of libraries was still in their collections, etc. I taught a doctoral seminar in 2005, and I said this was one of the arguments, and literally every doctoral student there laughed. They thought, really? They thought that? Of course everything could be online. Or, to be a little bit more nuanced, everything that matters will be online. Now, argue, disagree. This is not my attempt to get into that discussion. The point was, it's this fatalism. This is what I think a lot of people in the world and a lot of industries suffer from, is a sense of fatalism. That is, this is what will happen. And my argument is, that's not enough. In fact, that's quite wrong. That we really do have a control, that our future is what we invent, back to my very second slide. And so what you need to do is where are we, where will it go if nothing else changes, but you need to also develop a preferred future. Where do you want to go? And so for Jennifer Alardi, she said, the present is that we now see instruction as important to what public libraries do. However, we're not doing a good job, but because we're not really being evaluated, assessed, and people aren't necessarily seeing that as our central role, nothing's going to change. I want a much more engaged learning style to happen within libraries. And so the preferred future is what do you want it to be? And there will always, always, always be a gap between your anticipated future and your preferred future. It may be itty-bitty. Or it may be a chasm. Right? It may be that I just want people to understand that libraries are about learning. They already sort of understand. I want to go a little further. Or I want us to totally revamp how we do education. Here's two futures of libraries for you. Future number one. People get it. We are not just the hipster cupcake version of libraries that is that we're cool today, but people understand we're learning and we're central and all of those stuff. And so we support our libraries better. That creates more positions in libraries. We train, hire more librarians. Yay! What about this future? There are fewer libraries in the future, but more librarians. We look at it and we say, all right, this idea of building big buildings with big collections works for certain things, but it doesn't work for a lot of other things, particularly as the information companies, organizations, whatever are dealing with is online. Why do we have to be in buildings to do it? Now, everyone ever heard the phrase, we're the only profession named after the building? I would say, just lie and say that they named the building after us, but that's all right. That's not true. Accountants got their names because they used to work at counting houses. And for my Dickens literature Christmas fans out there, right? Scrooge ran a counting house, right? And poor Bob Marley, no, not Bob Marley, he would be in the Reagan. Emma.
Which is true, which is even better. The idea that you had to date your records, you had to take them to a counting house, an accountancy. They would do your records, your taxes, and give you your records back. And someone finally realized, this is annoying. I'm just going to hire you to come work for me. And the large accountancies that used to be the big six and then became the big five, and now it's like Accenture, and oh, we're not really accounting houses anymore, transformed when suddenly CFOs, accountants, became in every business had to have an accountant. As tax code, every individual soon has to go to an accountant to help them with their taxes. There are more accountants now than ever before, and no counting houses. Is that a future that we would prefer? Right? One of the arguments is, if we keep librarians in buildings, and we keep them as municipal agents of government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there isn't a real market thing to improve our salaries. But if we suddenly are seen as valuable working in Yahoo and Google and World Bank and whatever, then suddenly we could see the entire profession change. Is that a preferred future? So my point of this isn't pick one. My point of this is you're going to be able to think about a preferred future. You don't just have to be stuck with, well, libraries have always existed. No, they haven't. Librarians are like farmers. We've existed for literally millennia as a profession. Maybe not called that, maybe not with the same, I mean, ALA didn't accredit the Babylonian librarians, but there was a Babylonian library. And if they did, they would have screwed it up. Right? But the reason that we have farmers today is not because they didn't change. It's because they changed dramatically. They have a lineage that goes back to, hey, wheat, what an idea, to now, which is gene mod crops and combines and large harvests, right? Librarianship's the same way. We have a tradition that goes back 4,000 years, but the reason we still have librarians is not because we didn't change, but because we were able to. So when we talk about where do we want our library to go, where do we want our community, your question about how to make it happen, right, often comes down to a culture, right? How do I change people's minds? And the first mind that we have to work on changing, the first mindset we have to change, is the fact that we can have some control over the future. I'm tired of hearing, I hear this thing, well, Google, right? Google's gonna, first of all, Google's not in the same business we are, right? They're in the advertising business. We are not. They're in the self-driving car business, which is scary. But anyway, not that Google's in it, just self-driving cars scary. So I have a teenage son. I actually prefer a self-driving car. Wait, I just changed my mind on this. All right, sorry. So the first thing is we have to understand that we have some control. And then we need to begin to identify between that preferred future and that anticipated future, there will be some gap of opportunity. This gap of opportunity is where we can make a change. We can go in and have a role to play. Every child will be ready for kindergarten. All right, the reality is they're not. And if nothing changes, if we as the libraries, we as librarians, we as a community don't do anything else, our education level is going to stay. I told you the Boeing story. Boeing got to South Carolina and said, we need a better workforce. They didn't just sit there and go, oh, well. We hope the planes don't fall out of the air. They said, we need a better workforce. We're going to make a better workforce. And by the way, they did not start Boeing Academy. They went to the school systems, and they went and began looking at partners investing. Right? And then they said, oh, that didn't work. We need to. And they began doing, you know, literacy, et cetera. But we have to understand that, yes, we are not complete control of our destiny. Right? An event happening in November may well change the world as we know it. It will change the world as we know it. Just good or bad, your choice. All right.
And it is your choice. Please vote.
All right. What's that gap? Once you can identify that gap, that preferred future. Jennifer Lark, we're doing education. It's very rote. It's old school. That's not what we need. What we need is more engaged, learning through play. Let's figure out how to do this. This then creates your agenda. Your agenda says if that's where we're going, I'm not going to make it all happen tomorrow. I'm not going to make it all happen instantaneously, and I'm not necessarily going to make it happen by myself, but I need a plan. And this is, I think, where we also have to change the mindset. Librarians, as many professions are, we are kit people. We want a kit. Makerspace is cool. I would like the Makerspace kit, please.
I have a faculty member, Heather Moorfield-Lang, does amazing stuff in makerspaces in schools, and she says, oh, I got one of those calls today. See, every other call of, we're doing a makerspace, what should I buy? Right? And she's really, I told her, you should just play with their minds. You need 300 Q-tips, exactly 54 pieces of plastic, this dimension. I mean, you know, it'd be fun, but, you know, her answer is, well, what do you want to accomplish? What are you doing? Who's there? Right? We know this from planning, but we need to begin to break it down, task, task, task. Don't think of it as one thing. If Jennifer wants libraries to have more engaged play, she said, I need to demonstrate what that looks like. I know that I'm going to eventually need librarians who are trained and value and understand this. To do that, I need to understand what it is they need to be trained in. To do that, I've got to try it and give examples. To do that, I've got to go out, and she formed a nonprofit institution. She actually started in her parents' house. So she lives in Ferguson. That's the other side when I tell the story. But she started going up to Louisiana, Louisiana, Missouri. Yeah, which is maybe I think about an hour from where she is, to her parents' house, and she used to invite the kids from the neighborhood into her parents' driveway, and she would bring makey makeys, and she would bring tennis balls, and she would bring things in paste, and she would, in essence, model it for herself so that she could feel like she knew what she was doing. And as she'd do it, she would then begin to invite her librarians to come join her so they could see what. And then, when she went to her library said, that's delightful. That's, no thanks. She formed a not-for-profit corporation, and she brought in people that she knew from the community who had seen this, who believed in it, and they actually rented out an abandoned building on Main Street that she could now do scheduled weekly libraries play, and a pop-up libraries, and she did it. And that then became, she now had a community. She had bought in board, she had examples, she had community members who wanted it, and so now when she went back to the library and said, we should do this, it's not her saying, we should do this. It's parents going, why aren't you doing that? So that idea of coming up with the task and thinking about it, that's step one. We as a field should not think about what is our future, it should be what do we want our future to be. Right? We in our library, we in our desk, in our group, in our whatever, what do we want it to be? Based on that, okay, what's the gap between it, and now what are the steps to move it? And so I want to now break you through a couple of those steps that I think are important to building a movement. Step number one, build linkable ideas. So ideas need a findable place on the web. I mean, that idea that not everything's on the web, only things that matter, matter. So you have an idea. You should have that idea ready to go. Take Jennifer's. You need your elevator speech. You need to be able to, within 3 minutes, explain what you want. And that's the language side. And you need to name everything. Right? So if you want to, for example, have the volunteers in our library feel better about the library by giving them donuts, call it the donut initiative. Right? Call it the volunteer improvement whatever. The point is, the minute you give it a name, people can refer to it, and it makes it seem bigger than just your crazy idea today. People think that initiative is a big deal. Let's do it. When it could be very small, it could be you and a friend. But the idea is then, all right, I heard about this. I was at Dave's lecture, and he was hearing about this Jennifer Lardy thing. I've got to go find it. So Jennifer built the website. And you're going to be tempted to go create a social media. You're going to go do a Facebook group for it, and that's fine. But Facebook, it's a closed community. It's really hard for people to find it. If they're not on Facebook, they're not going to really see much of it. So I push for an open web. But ultimately, the people you're going to influence is where you need to be. Right? Is that a local intranet? Is that a local group to your community? What have you? And be as linkable is invitations to be part of. That is, okay, so you gave me a 3-minute speech. Jennifer, I love it. We're going to do play. It's going to be engaged. That's great. How can I help? I cannot tell you the number of times that's where the conversation starts. I love this. Oh, let's do it. What can I do? And the answer is, I didn't think about that. Is that an ask for money? Is that an ask for time? Is that an ask for resources? Is that an ask for an introduction? Where do you go from here? What's the ask? You need the ask. If you're saying, you know, my library, oh, my administrator doesn't get it. Okay, have you actually asked the administrator to do something? If the answer is yes and they haven't, I got it. But have, so many times, people have this sort of ill-formed idea, they go, we should do more community stuff. And the director sits there and goes, well, we've done community stuff in the past. Well, the answer is, all right, community stuff isn't specific enough. And the other part is, we should do some community outreach. We should begin by meeting with the United Way. Would you call that meeting? It's a very different thing than, you know, you've got to put people on the spot. If you want ideas to move forward, you have to have a partnership where people have skin in the game, where they all feel that they're part of it. Once you have a linkable idea, you need to then build a collection. Now, this sounds really hilarious, telling librarians you need to build a collection. But we need to build a collection around the idea, right? So when Jennifer did this, did she videotape with the permissions of the parents the kids playing and what it looked like? Did she document flyers that she put up so she could share it? Did she create a business plan? Did she give a presentation at a conference that could be webcast? Did she, the idea that we generate, when we have an idea we're really passionate about, we generate a huge amount of data. We generate reading lists. We read everything we can find on it. Did you actually record the articles that you read that led you to the idea? Did you record the books, etc.? I mean, it's amazing because we're so busy pushing the idea, we don't document our own process, and then we expect people can catch up without coming through the same process. So what is it that's going to bring me up? How can I see this? How can you demonstrate it, right? So with the example I gave before about the library's strategic plan, they had meetings. The meetings had minutes. The minutes were documented. They had enrollment. They knew who came. They knew all these kinds of things. There's a whole document around. Right? There's a concept called open software. You've probably heard it, right? Getting free or open software. Be an open effort. Share it widely. Right? Part of it is, oh, don't tell anyone. Right? Jennifer was like, wasn't like this way. But she could have said, I got a great idea. Don't want anyone to steal it. Don't tell anyone. But if you can make, once again, starting with phase one, a linkable idea, you bring people in. There's a great TED Talk. I still like TED Talks. I know that they're now out of vogue. I like that. And one was on how movements get started. And they said the key to getting a movement started isn't the first person. It's the first follower. It's not the person who says it first or whatever. It's the person who stands up and says, that's a good idea. That endorsement is as important as the someone having the idea. Right? Who's your follower? Who's the next person? And by the way, the dynamic then becomes you don't know who the leader and follower is, so if we go that way. But it begins with someone saying, I'm willing to invest in this. Invest my time, my effort. You've got to talk, you've got to share. And if there's one community who is, by the way, fabulous at this, it's the entrepreneur community. Entrepreneurs that are any good are a walking Rolodex. More so than anything else, they are a set of networks and connections. So when we were going, and I'll show you in a little bit, when we were going to work on redoing our bachelor's program, I talked to this great entrepreneur, Trey Gordon. And Trey's like, okay, you got to talk to this person, this person, this person, this person. And you talk to them, and they say, all right, you got to talk to this person, this person. And that network that you begin to build becomes invaluable. So, but when you go to that network, do you have an idea? Does it have a name? Is it linkable? And can people find it and contribute to it? So with that undergraduate program, I could say, Trey told me I should talk to you. Really love your opinion. Can you come next Thursday? We'll talk about it. That's great. Would you talk to someone else about it? Would you break? So suddenly I'm getting people invested in it because I want them to work on it. So we have, right, we've moved from movie trailers to now we have book trailers. Do you have your idea trailer? Do you have something in a minute that someone can play off of YouTube that says, if we do this, even if it's shared only with your director or your colleagues, take the time to document what you're talking. Don't make it a droning PowerPoint like I'm doing. Build a narrative. So we know where we want to go. We've sort of given that some reality by giving it a name, giving it a place on the web, inviting people to it. We're building a sort of collection to show that there's some weight behind it, that there's some effort behind it. But have we given a narrative, a story that someone can tell someone else? Right? You've got your 3 minutes. You've ever done this? You sat through something like this or watched a video? Yes, that's great. And then 2 days later, you're trying to share it, and you're like, I have no idea. It's like me and jokes. You know, you tell the first half of the joke, and then the second half, you just blow the punchline. Right? So, all right. Tell a story. Every presentation you give should be a journey. That agenda you've laid out, that agenda is important. It makes sense. We know in the library world the power of narrative. We know stories change lives. Be a story. Make yourself, or better yet, the partner you want to involve, make them the hero of the story. If we do this, can you imagine the response that we'll get? Right? What's the story? How do we tell that story? All too often, we put out a strategic plan or we put out a policy, and we never tell the story behind it. And so people end up re-arguing the same thing over and over again, or how do we get that buy-in? Or you should talk about, I did. Did you see that? If you don't tell the story, people don't know how to do it. So what's your narrative? Think in tweets. I hate Twitter. I see all the thing about people wanting to buy Twitter, and I'm like, let it die. Because then I can get off of it. Because I love sharing with some great people, but then the other part happens for Twitter. And so anyway, but the idea of compressing things down to 142 characters is a powerful, 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 useful thing. We used to at Syracuse, if you were giving a speech, you had to give us a Twitter version of your abstract, so you tweet it out. And some people would say, oh, I can't ever compress my grand thoughts into 142 characters. I'm like, no, no. And it's not that, the point is not that there isn't a deep, long, three-day conversation. It's the point of how did you get enough to get, can you distill it? We had another verb when I was in the doctoral program. We called it dissertating. If you ask someone who was in a doctoral program, you said, what's your topic? And they were still talking 20 minutes later. They were not ready to defend. They were dissertating. That is, they were trying to find the logical argument, and you were just happy to be present for that part. What's your dissertation? Think in tweets. So I'll give you an example. Our undergraduate program. I have now been at two programs that have undergraduate programs. Three with Dominican. In information science. I was at Syracuse for 25 years on faculty. We had an undergraduate program. If you asked me, as many doctors did, so what is that undergraduate program? I would dissertate. Well, it's that intersection of technology and people, and it was like this expressive dance, and somewhere in the middle. And we're having the same problem at South Carolina. Oh, we have a bachelor's degree in information science. If you ever want to have the book, that blank look, talk to an 18-year-old about information science. Come and be an information scientist. Right? Meanwhile, the person next to me, you want to be a reporter? Fine, sign here. Well, I get that. You want to be a lawyer? Got it. Right? Want to be an engineer? Even if you don't know what an engineer is, fine, I'll be an engineer. Information science? And so we were having this discussion with this network of people. We said, talking about what it is, et cetera. And one of them had the most brilliant statement. He said, oh, what you're looking for is geeks with social skills. And I said, yes. And you should have seen all the faculty land, but they all went, yes. And so, and by the way, this is not unique to us. There are other geeks with social skills. You search the web, you'll find t-shirts, you'll find whatever. But for us, it was like this moment of realization. And in fact, the very next day, I went out and ordered my skin for my iPad. Because now, they get it. Right? We went to an open house where all these accepted seniors would come and say, should I come to South Carolina? And we put up the poster. And we would get people going, but if he has in the conversation, or yes, I found my tribe. Right? Or we get people who go, you know, it's all right, we have waivers for non-geeks, but we can bring you in. And, but it just, it made a, you know, it was something that we could concretely say. So what is that concrete thing? Is it community impact? Kindergartners ready to read? Vibrant community? Whatever that theme is, I know it sounds cheap and markety, but it disciplines your mind around making that argument. Because I can take this and deconstruct it. The in search of part, well, searching is a key integral part to information science, information seeking behavior, social skills, because we have social science, right? I can do that. But I got, by the way, our dean of engineering hates this. I was going to put these up in big 18-foot high banners on our building. and I ran it by the computer engineering folks, and they're like, yeah, fine. And the dean said, absolutely not. If you do that, I will go to the provost and we'll have a discussion about what a geek is. What I realized is, first of all, there are geeks without them. But it also turns out, you know, a lot of the engineers and computer scientists were really, I mean, honestly, they were sort of tortured with the geeks. I mean, it was the nerds and geeks, it really hurt. And so I get that, and I need to be careful of it. In our field, we've come to adopt geek, right? Geeks in the Library program, which I love. You know, you can geek not just technology, but knitting and, you know, all this stuff. So I get that. And for 18-foot high banners on campus is not the time for a new one. So, you know, step back. But I also, it's a perfect decision point for knowing who should go into what college. I resent that. Here's computer science. Yeah, geek's awesome. Come right here. So this idea of what's that narrative, what's that message, how do we get that in, how do we explain it, how do we make it encapsulate, how do we invite people into this process? And always go big. Always, always go big. We are going to fundamentally change how children learn in the library. We are going to adopt the latest in pedagogy. We are going to make kids understand they can do anything by actually having them do anything. We are going to take them from a school situation where they feel stilted and unheard in a curriculum that pounds them with standardized testing to the point they don't learn, and we're going to put them in a situation where they are going to revel in understanding science and technology in a new way. Oh, yeah. As opposed to, we're going to play in the library. Go big. You will never lose by going big. I learned this from a fellow by the name of Eric Miller. We were working on a project, and it was a search engine. We're going to take the sites that librarians send people to and turn that into a sort of trusted set of resources. Lots of interesting stuff there. But, and he's at one point goes, so why are we doing this project? And I said, well, you know, we have the search engine. He goes, no, we're going to make librarianship more relevant than ever. I sat back and I said, you son of a... You just made me feel really small. In a good way. And I learned that. You never lose by going big. You can get picked on, trust me. You can be claimed that you are overgeneralizing, and that's not wrong. You are overgeneralizing. But what you're doing is you need people in the conversation, so then you can get into the nuance. Then you can work on part of it, but it's not going to happen if they don't care about it to begin with. So go big. Narrative's important. Strategic, when you do the annual reports, and it's, we circulated this many books, we had these many people through the gate count. 2016 was a revolutionary year. We talked about, you know, in society and whatever. Anyone see all the infographics? More people went to the New York Public Library than attended all the Mets and Yankees games combined. That's a narrative, right? That tells a story very differently from X number of people came. We know, for example, circulation statistics are horrible because our boards look at them every month. And we know there's a natural fluctuation that happens every month, right? Circulation, at Christmas time, down. Last day of classes, down, right? And we know that. And so, why is this down from last month? Well, because it was last month. And telling narratives of, yes, but over time, the trend is, the median is, et cetera. Makes sense. So, go big, tell narratives. And build tools. So, there's a fellow by the name of, well, he's dead, but he was a nice guy. Lewin. And Lewin was a research change management. And what he said was, he looked at organizations, he looked at how do you bring about change. And he came up with this idea that says, most people, when they're in their daily lives, their daily activities, he was talking about business, so when they're doing their job, are in a frozen state. That means they can anticipate what they're doing, what they do is almost automatic, they understand it, they're comfortable. We're in a frozen state in many cases. And his argument, by the way, wasn't frozen is bad. He said, this is natural. This is what people do. When you woke up this morning, you had to get here. If you drove, you kind of assumed you had a car. You kind of assumed that the car was going to work. You didn't get up an hour early every day to make sure that your car was going to start. Right? Unless you had that kind of car. You've made a bad decision. I'm sorry. Right? But he goes, we're frozen. He says, to get someone to change, the first thing you have to do is unfreeze them, right? So this is frozen,
same as you want. This is, and then what you need to do is move them to an unfrozen state. And it goes, the way you move people to an unfrozen state is two ways. Librarians are good at one of them. The first way is you want to give them a vision of why something is better. If you make this change, you will be, your life will be better. Librarians are great at this.
You are.
Oh, it'll be easier, it'll take us less time, et cetera, management. This is the argument we like to make. He says, that's great. The other half of the argument is the one that as individuals, as people, we tend to avoid, which is you need to make them very uncomfortable with where they are. Not only do you have to incent them to move to the, you know, golden city on the hill, you have to tell them if they don't move, bad things are going to happen. If we don't do this, we're going to lose our budget. If we don't do this, we'll become irrelevant. If we don't do this, right, why should I bother changing? And then he says, the next most important state and the things that are often forgotten, which is you must, at this point, refreeze them. Because no one can exist in a constant state of flux and stress. We know that because we've tried it. And what do? We go home and we drink. I mean, that's what we do. Your alcohol may be in the form of a nice book, Netflix binge watching, but it's all just a matter of addiction. But that's the point. If people don't refreeze, they will. What will they do? They will revert back to their previous circumstances. They will fight you like hell, never to move on. So what does that mean, refreezing? Okay, we are going to adopt community reference. We want you as reference librarians on a regular basis to go out to community organizations. So tomorrow, you're going to go to the better. You're going to go to the Chamber of Commerce. And I want you to be there, and I want you to listen, and I want you to contribute. Now, this happened in Salt Lake City, it's happened in Colorado, a bunch of people have tried it. The librarians are often like, well, what do I do? And the answer is, all right, if someone came up to the desk as a reference librarian, what would you do? Well, I would listen to their question, I would figure out how you contribute, and then I would give them an answer. That's what you're going to do. You may just sit tomorrow. You may sit the month after that. You may sit the month after that. But at some point, you're going to say, by the way, did you know? You're going to have something to contribute. And I'm not going to just have you sit in the Chamber of Commerce. I'm going to have you sit in the Arts Council, too. And I'm going to have you sit right. So now you can actually, did you know that they were doing so you're doing right? And that idea began to make sense. They began to become comfortable. But if I'm now set, you're going to the Chamber of Commerce, I now put you in your car, out of the building, on a regular basis. Time for annual evaluations. Why aren't you in the building more? You told me not to. And you, I see you answered less reference questions at the reference. I'm not there. If you don't change performance evaluation metrics, if you don't change bonus schemas, if you don't change those kinds of worlds, if you don't build ways in which they get rewarded, it won't happen. So as an example, in Salt Lake City, Peter Brubert did this. He said, I created a form. They had to go, and whenever they did one of these visits, they had to put it into a system. And it showed them by branch how many people were doing these things. And he says, when they first brought up the system, the first thing he did is it showed every branch and the number of times they were in these distributed records. And so when they entered it, it suddenly gave them a peer effect. Oh, they've done more than that. Oh, they've done more. And it began to become, that system created a new norm, a new frozen, where this was the way you report your activity, this is the way we reward that activity. All too often, we build in systems where we say, we're going to move to floating reference, get rid of the desks. And people are like, no, you can't have my desk. The problem is, you say, the reason we want you to do this is unless you get out there within the community, they won't know you, they won't support you. Yeah, but I won't have a desk. So you know what Corinne Hill did in Dallas? She bought all the librarians neckties or scarves that were the sort of colors of the logo, because it was a way of them identifying, I'm a librarian. And she replaced this with this, but this was still a necessary thing for the librarian so that they knew that when they were out amongst them, they had a level of identification authority. This was their protection. She had to refreeze them with another set. So this idea of building tools is not just a matter of saying, yes, software, etc. But you're building standards, you're building evaluation metrics, you're building
books, materials, etc., events around this new idea. You're creating ways where people can contribute. So back to that ask, this is how they can ask. So what's Jennifer doing? She built this institution, then she's writing the book, then she's selling the book. Right? How many IMLS grants have we all been a part of that we said we'll go to a conference and tell someone about it? That's not necessarily the most interactive way to engage in what you're doing. Is there some other way of making that happen? So you got to build tools.
So the bottom line, and where I thought we could spend a few more minutes, if you're all right, is we could try. So this is my, and by the way, I'll have this up on my website and whatever I can share with you folks, so you can send it out as well. And you'll notice at the bottom, what is this? One, this is a tool. Two, this is a tool with an invitation. Right? This is, right, I want you to think about it this way. I'm giving you a tool to help you think about this way. If you disagree, here's a mechanism for input, right? We're trying to do this. But it says, there it is, linkable ideas, collections, narratives, tools. What are we talking about? Give me some specifics, give me some examples. So let's try it. Give me a grand idea, or give me a little idea. Give me a change that you would love to champion. It could be within the field, it could be within your library.
We're going fines free.
Fines free, great. So, let us all now take a moment to walk through this. So, first of all, let's make this a linkable idea. So, within a linkable idea, we have to give it a name. Actually, I like fines free. What else could we do with them? Let's think about that for a minute. Fines free is one, but are there other ways, other names we could use that might have a different impact or different use?
Pay no more.
Pay no more. Right? So, why would someone respond, say, to pay no more versus fines free?
Finish that book.
Finish that book. Actually, right.
Unlimited access.
No worries.
No worries.
Finds freedom.
Finds freedom. All right. So, if you look at these for a moment, it may sound silly, but one, each of those gives you a different story. Just the name of it. Fines free. Fines free is great if you understand what a fine is. Right? And if you define it as a fine. So if you're a regular library user, I understand the term. If you're a librarian, I understand the term. If I've never used a library, I have no idea what you're talking about. Just as an example. Fines freedom, right? I see eagles. I see red, white, and blue, but that's a different connotation. Finish that book is, you know, that's a different group that you're communicating to. So who do you want to communicate to? But my point is, just that simple matter of giving them a name that will be understandable, accessible to others is important. Right? The next thing is to make it linkable. So what could we put together at findsfreedom.org? Now, Dave, we have a website. Fine. Give me a space on the website. But give me a page. Don't give me a paragraph. Use a bit.ly, a small URL. Something where people can very quickly find this. I heard it. I want to find it. So, something like that. What could we put here that could invest people? What are we actually going to link to on our own? We all want to be in security land now. What are we going to link to? What do we want people to find when they go to that URL?
Information, possibly some examples of libraries that have done it.
Okay.
Articles about, you know, pros and cons.
Benefits of checking out the book at this library or checking out materials.
Okay. Because we're now what we're doing is we're melding, which is fine, into our collection. This isn't just a bunch of stuff. This is targeted. We're making an argument. We're trying to persuade people.
And so things like examples. Examples are a very specific type of persuasion. It's you're gaining authority by the crowd, right? And you want to be careful with the examples you pick, right? You never want to pick the neighboring library district. Never, because they're evil, right? Right? You always, well, the Harvard Public Library, I know there's one, it does this, right? Who is it, what examples are they, because they're bigger and more impressive? Is it because they look like you? Is it, you know, what is it, the example? Is it just that they have an example? We saw this a lot with the idea of how many people replaced fines with food donations. Anyone? How many people did not realize that there was that much stovetop stuffing in their life? That's, you know, it's a great idea, but suddenly it's like, oh, gee, I didn't know irradiated canned peas expired after 88 years, but thanks for that one. But what are we doing? What are the benefits? What are the examples? And what's nice is, back to this, the benefits are you don't have to worry, this is versus, this one could be, you've already paid for it. Your taxes at work, right? It drives me nuts when I hear about free public libraries. Versus finish that book. The benefits are you no longer have to be in a rush. But then people are going to say, but I'm never going to get that book. So here's where your pros and cons, where you can talk about controls, et cetera, et cetera. So what other kinds of collections can we put around this idea? So we've got examples, we've got articles, a discussion of benefits. Testimonials. The idea of, by the way, I can't spell Latin. Did that work?
Yeah.
All right. Testimonials or the idea of profiles. Now, obviously, this one, well, we'll go big in a moment. Look at Fred. Fred loved this book. This book changed his life. If he had had to return it when he did, it would have cost him $50. Be like Fred, right? Who are you? Who do you want to give those pictures to? How do you make it real to them? How do you get those testimonies? How do you gather data? And then the other one, which you probably want to do as this thing rolls out, is you probably do want some sort of statistics or some sense of how well it's working. Right? Did this bankrupt us? Right? I see that all the time. Systems. We're going to go to Find Free. We'll be back. We'll lose a huge amount of money out of our input. How would we ever live? You have to, if you imagine that, right? So you're in a 12 library system, and you want to go find three. And you go to the meeting, and they're all like, but if you go, then we have to go. Or they'll hate us. And you're like, no, they won't hate you at all. Now, what you're linking to in the collections and narratives are going to be different than necessarily your community. Right? How do we make that? How do we differentiate that? Because when I say it has to be linkable, it doesn't have to be linkable to everyone or linkable to the same stuff. But we have to talk about that. So we've got our name that's linkable. We've got the idea of the collections. Now let's talk about some narratives. Give me some, let's go with the, give me the narrative around Pay No More.
One thing is that it indicates that there's a change, something is new.
Okay.
It means you used to pay, but now you don't pay.
Right.
And it doesn't use the word fines, so
right.
It perhaps is more accessible to a greater number of people.
Go big. No, go big. Go bigger.
Okay. It will encourage people to borrow things from the library without fear of fines, or it'll make it more accessible to people who worry about money.
Go bigger.
Check out more books because you don't have to. You'll check out more of everything.
Why do you check out books?
Tell a story of why that child checked out that book and then he'd be able to have access more than GPA and AMS tests.
We are going to solve social inequity in our community by removing the barriers of time to learn. Now, I know you're all sitting there going, oh, God. And I'm not saying you have to go that big every time. I'm fine for, you know, I get this one. But think about that for a moment, because we do this all the time. If we remove fines, people will check out more books. Who cares? You do, because that's your statistic. They don't. They care they don't have to find the money, so that might have been a barrier before. They care that they may be able to finish that book. They care, right? So first of all, that narrative is, who are you trying to persuade? Are you trying to persuade your internal audience, right? So we are going to find some more. I have to talk to my board of trustees to get rid of this revenue source. I better have a narrative. And I'm telling you, that board, that narrative better be something to the effect of, these poor kids that can't afford it are suddenly going to learn. Versus, you're at the desk every Thursday. Could you imagine not having to sit with that stupid lockbox? That idea that we could, do you know how much clerk time we could free up? Or do you know how we would not be putting our clerks at risk in this neighborhood by having cash on hand? Who are you trying to, so these are all have to be targeted, but my point of those big narratives is we often think there's only one narrative, and it's almost always from our perspective. And so the notion of going big is, what's the narrative, who are we trying to persuade, and what's the biggest narrative that we can get without an eye roll towards that? And sometimes this will be bundled, right? So it will be, finish that book, and finish that book will be, we're also going to highlight our online book offering so that you can finish that book if you're on the beach, if you're on an airplane, right? You can finish that book, it's not going to come, right? So we might be bundling them together. But that concept of the narrative, right? I can tweet out, kids can read for free. Kid, learning unbounded and unfined.
So if you're gonna have this idea, but if the community isn't part of that, is if you haven't asked your users, you can't tell the story because it's from your side.
That's right.
So I want to make sure.
That's right. Well, I want to be really clear, because I use community really widely. A library is a community. Meaning we have a bunch of workers, we have a board, we have, et cetera. We have a professional community. Right? So find free, the first person we may want to be talking about is within that community. But you're right. You start by, what is that message going to make sense? Are they worried about the money? Are they worried about the hassle? Are they worried about the justice? I have heard social justice arguments around keeping funds. Right? We can do all the, we're making things accessible to the world, and someone will say, and you're allowing those who have that book to deprive the rest of society of access. That's an argument that people, right? There's an equity argument for funds. You should take responsibility for what you do. Or, we have limited resources, we must be stewards of those resources, fines are only a good practice. Knowing that that's within that community, you're right, you need to know it, and then, once again, invite people in. Invite people to make it, and part of that's trying it out. Trust me, you know, I know that the Dean of Engineering does not get this poster, right? But I at least understood what the resistance was. By the way, he had a really good argument. He said something to the effect of, if we keep referring to technologists and engineers as geeks, they become anonymized and you begin to make them interchangeable. We should be preparing innovators and leaders. And so the idea is, oh, the project's going to get rid of the geeks. Oh, we can move the geeks offshore. Oh, throw some more geeks at it, as opposed to, these are professionals. Which is a great, once again, in his field, he understands that field, that's an argument, that made sense to me. In our field, that's not the community, so the messages can be different. But you're absolutely right, this has got to be tested.
Well, I think it's in defining the need, too, before you even get to some of these points, you have to.
Well, you're right, and this is a good point. This is how to sell it, not necessarily how to develop it.
Right.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely. Okay, so we have a narrative. Now let's talk tools. How are we going to now make this real for people? How are we going to get them involved and on board?
Create a hashtag.
Okay. What's the hashtag help you do?
Get the info out to the community.
Right. So you're right. So the idea of a distribution mechanism through things like a hashtag, or whether it's a Facebook group or what have you. All right, other types of tools. We're selling the idea. We're not necessarily implementing it yet, but that'll come. How did you know? What tools can we use to implement this?
Media?
Right. So we want to be able to get the newspaper to come in and report on this, or the local paper, etc. We want to bring them in. What about, and I hate this one, but I'm going
to
put
who are we trying to sell this to? Because if I'm trying to sell this to my board and I'm bringing the media and putting the hashtag,
the last thing I want to do,
I'm losing my job.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And so the idea here is, once again, that's the big question that sits behind all of this. That was your question as well, which is, okay, who are we selling this to? But my argument is, regardless of who you're selling to, you're probably going to need to put these together, but they're going to need to be shaped. Because you're right. If my board said, no, that's a bad idea, Mick, and then you go and do the hashtag, and then you bring the media, you're right. Thanks for coming. So knowing the order and being strategic about it is absolutely important, knowing the vision. But when we now go to try and get people to implement or adopt this, petitions are a form of tools. Right? Ballots are a form of tools. Hashtags are part of tools. Participation is part of tools. Or is it a matter of contribution? So with Jennifer Ilardi, while she was now working outside the library domain, she needed a legal mechanism, non-for-profit status, so that she could begin having people give her funds to do some of these things. Is that something? These may be, once again, this is an example of something very internal, but they can be very large in the sense of you look at what Corinne Hill has done with the notion of patron-driven acquisition. Now, patron-driven acquisition is a lovely little internal discussion and debate that we can go through and go into our philosophy. But Corinne bought it wholesale. Loved it. If there's a book that one of your patrons wants, don't do interlibrary loan. Don't wait for them to buy it. Now, she did this when she moved to Chattanooga. The reason she did this is because Chattanooga's collection was woefully out of date. They had to invest a huge amount of money to bring the collection up to date. And they could have started anywhere. And so what she said is, we're going to start with what people want. Now, once again, as an academic, I can sit back, well, you might get an imbalance of different community. I get that. But she started with, we had to dig out of a hole. And was it the old Bill Clinton statement? When you find yourself in a hole, your first step is to stop digging. And her thing was, you know, our first step is just someone who's going to pay for the taxes and who's going to evaluate the services. We're going to empower them, and that's going to give us. She then took that and began to talk to conferences about it. You know, and she's not the one who developed patron-driven by any means, but she took it and it became part of her platform saying, look at what Chattanooga is doing. And that became a whole public outreach to first the citizens of Chattanooga and then the larger community said, this is a great public library. Look at us, aren't we cool? Same thing. You can take something as simple as finish the book. Implement it within your local community, and then go like crazy and start talking about how your library is influential within the field. And showing up at the Illinois Library Association, and then you show up at ALA, and then you show up and you do the article that goes into American Libraries, and then you, right? It may sound, once again, you look at this as a very procedural thing, but there's nothing that stops you from taking it to what is it part of a broader discussion. I've now written three books around the central concept that people learn through conversation. That's literally where it started. And you people bought some of them. It's really hilarious. You take that idea and you break it down, and once again, where do you want to get with it? And so this is where I have the institutional versus individual conversation. Do you want to push your library forward? Great. Do you want to push your career forward? Do you have a vision, right? When Jennifer Lardy had an idea and found out she couldn't do it within the confines of her institution, she didn't say, oh, well. She went and did it outside of the confines of her institution, and eventually, I think she's still working at the library, but her goal is clearly to start this up and to move it and to sell it and talk about it. With IVU, part of that lesson and curriculum was, all right, you have a project. How do you sell it? How do you push it forward? How do you sustain it? What is, you know, back to this, what's the title of the Illinois librarians? What's your narrative? Are you the most innovative group in the country? Or are you the suffering librarians in the most dysfunctional state government out there? Because that's interesting, because it's there. Right? And back to that control. How many citizens walk in and assume that you're, by the way, funded by the state? How many citizens wondering when you're closing because everything else is? How many citizens don't want to vote for your tax because they already thought that they paid for it some other way? In New York,
they had to vote on library budgets at the same time they voted on school budgets. What that meant was everyone thought the library was part of the school system, and so when they saw that the library was asking for 10%, the school was only asking for 2%, they wondered what was wrong here. What's the narrative you want to get out? And that's back to that control system, right? It's not what's happening to you. Clearly, the state government and funding system is done to you. Clearly. What are you going to do with it? What's the narrative? What is your preferred future? Is it a functional government? Love it. What Gina Millsap said in Topeka was, I don't think I can fix that. What I can fix is I can fix Topeka. I can work with these different institutions and I can bring it together. Sarah Feldman last night talked about, she has in her area served, what was the number, 47 mayors? Her county, the Cuyahoga County Public Library serves 47 different mayors. She says she meets with one every week. To the point, by the way, where the mayors come from. She meets with them every week. Why? Because she's independent. She's her own special district. She doesn't need to go to them for budget. She doesn't need to go for them. They have a separate budget, separate board, etc. Why does she meet with them? Because she wants a narrative so that they say, I have the best library in my town. I am well served by this council. She's controlling the narrative around funding, around government. And so the question becomes, way back to where we began, what is the future you want? What is your preferred future? Don't sit back and assume it's going to happen. Begin talking about building it, making it, controlling the narrative. Libraries are an amazing thing. Libraries as institutions are new. Libraries transform. Talking about the expert in libraries, talking about new librarianship, expect more. All of these are phrases that allow us to quickly get into the consciousness of people. We have a problem right now with information science. No one knows what it is. No 18-year-old knows what it is, and every librarian's pissed off that you change your name. Unless we are proactive and go, this is what we're doing. We have a generational problem. If you might remember my opening remarks. Why are we thrilled that Dominican has changed his name to life to information studies? Because this is allowing them to focus on what they do, on increasing their role in the university, and increasing the opportunity for librarians in their generational time. As opposed to, oh, libraries aren't sexy, government. What's the narrative? What's going on right now? I know, Skokie. I'll pick on Mick for a minute. Well, if I may share our conversation, I'm going to do it anyway. Some libraries do really cool things, and they're okay with no one knowing because they're doing really cool things. Some libraries feel it really important to be seen as doing really cool things. Right? We know that. Some personalities, some librarians, all of these folks, how much time do they spend on the road? How much time are they here? What's a mover and shaker? Oh, my God. That drives me nuts. That we can look at movers and shakers and say, oh, mover and shaker, well, I did one.
Can't we all celebrate each other? It's okay.
What's the narrative? What are we pulling together? What's your narrative for your career and your impact on the community? What's your library's narrative? What's your state's narrative? What's the country's narrative? What's the profession's narrative? These are things we can control. And the future that I started before was one narrative. It's a narrative that I'm certainly not alone in and that I'm pushing, though. It's a narrative of libraries and knowledge and learning and making better decisions. What is the value of a library? It helps communities make better decisions. Very different narrative than the oasis from the storm. Not the better, not the worse, but what is your narrative? We were talking last night that how many of your paraprofessionals, how many people have worked at your library and don't understand the basic principles and values that librarians have taught? I get them. Kate gets them. We get folks who come into libraries. I've been in a library for 15 years. I get this. Why am I here? I get the paper. I'm out. Then we start talking about the importance of privacy. And they suddenly like, oh, what? And we start talking about what does freedom of intellectual access mean? And they're like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. Why is it when someone says, I don't like this book on my stack, we don't just take it off? Oh, we don't? Why don't we? How much of that narrative is in your library? How much of the volunteers know that? One of the things I see, particularly in academic libraries, not exclusively, is we go and hire people that we need from other fields. We need a technologist, go get a technologist. We need a social worker, go bring in a social worker. We need someone to do tutoring. We need an educator. We bring them in and we put them in their place. And we wonder why they don't integrate with the culture. Have they gotten the narrative? Have they been told the story? Do you have the story? What is the story? There's this, when you put a makerspace in your library, do you put it in because every other library has a makerspace, or do you say, we really think that we have a community of entrepreneurs, or a community of hands-on folks, or teenagers who? What's the narrative behind it? Yes, that is, knowing your community, knowing why you're doing, knowing what you're talking about. Absolutely. But it starts with a proactive vision of shaping the future, not simply being passive to it. That's what this all comes down to. We develop, we create the future through invention, not through waiting to see what arrives at our doorstep. We have to get out. We have to move. We have to spend time at the soccer field. We have to spend time at the train stations. We need a narrative. And we need a narrative that spans and increasingly includes our entire community so that when the sheriff goes, oh, we're a community that learns, right? And the school, we're a community that learns, and United Way, we're a community that learns, we're all community learns, and it's in our strategic plan, your strategic plan, we sit together on a regular basis. That's the narrative that we're going with. And while that's a really broad, it sounds great, how you get there, there are ways of getting it. And it starts with, what is it? Is it linkable? How do you talk about it? What collection is it? How do we build tools to implement it, etc.? We're a community that reads. Okay, what does that mean? Some are reading. Fine. Every community reads the same book. Fine. That's a tool. But it has to connect to a narrative or else it's an annoyance. Right? It's like a book group. Well, the first law of book group, never talk about book group. The second law of book group, only half the people are going to read the damn book. Let's be honest. Is that what we want? Does it fit our narrative? Does a makerspace fit our narrative? And who are we communicating that narrative to? Are we doing it because Chattanooga had one, and Cuyahoga has one, and we got to have one too? Or is it because our community, we're going to be a place where people make things? Fayetteville Free Library, first public library makerspace. They put in a bunch of 3D printers. They were on carts. They literally had to wheel them out. But they were makerspace. And Sue Constantine, who I like a lot, Sue Constantine really wants everyone to know what's happening in Fayetteville. Right? She's a relentless self-promoter, library promoter. I have no problem. Then they began having 3D printers, they began having tools, they began laser etcher machines. So now they have this really cool, they even got funding from the state to renovate part of an old building so they can have a beautiful makerspace. And so people came in, and then what happens is adults would come in with their kids, and the adults would go back to the makerspace, and the kids would sit there and go, what about me? And then what they did is they built, for teens, they built a studio with a green screen and all the videos they wanted and made and places to do Minecraft and such. And so now teenagers had places, the tweens were sitting there going, what about me? And what they did was they took the youth area and they took a corner of the room, and they put up in big letters, little makers, they put boxes full of broken watch parts and construction paper and glue, and the kids would come and make a creation put it on the wall. And what they did is eventually, now they consider people come in, do we call them patrons, do we call them customers? They call everyone who comes in a maker. They say, you can make stuff in our makerspace, you can make stuff in a little makerspace, you can make ideas in your head by reading, you can make new opportunities for yourself, you can, the idea though is our community is an active community of makers. That's a narrative that all those fit into as opposed to, yes, we've got a 3D maker. Why? Because you're supposed to have one. What's your narrative? When those folks come in, are they makers? Are they readers? We love readers. Readers was, right, this was when life was comfortable. We were okay with patrons and readers. But now there's other stuff. What's the narrative? They didn't learn. Customers? Are they job seekers? Are they economic development people? Are they Richard Florida? What is it? The creative class. That Athnone community someone mentioned before? Trust me, being called rich is lovely. Being called the creative class is much better. Being called the leisure class, you know, that's 20s. But anyway, what is the narrative? And then, and this goes back to the beginning, once you develop this narrative and these tools, you need to, back to your point, back to your point, back to all your point, be a community-wide narrative. Because if you are a narrative, if you are a library of makers in a town of consumers, if you are a community of readers in a city of the unemployed, that's a problem. Why do we have to make sure that every kid's ready for kindergarten? Because our city is all about learning and education. Why do we want a vibrant, dynamic economy? Because we're in the entrepreneurship. What's the narrative? What's the story of your community? And what role does the library play in it? Then you give it a name, you make it linkable, you build collections to prove it, you have that narrative that you're putting out, and you build tools to demonstrate it. Whether it's Find Freedom, finish that book, unlimited access, pay no more, make whatever it is. That's how it fits together. So if you take nothing away from today, take that one thing, which is control your narrative. Control the story. What shall be the future that we create together, not what is the future that will happen to us. Fair enough? All right. Comments, questions, not enough. I mean, seriously, are those some of the tools? What other things are you going to run into when you go back and these are great ideas, Bob?
From the tools that I'll use, I really like what you just said, not what are we going to create as opposed to what's going to happen to us.
Right.
So, I mean, from that, you can start a conversation to have more.
Right.
The exact tools, I'm not sure.
But that's a big starting point for me. And what I've discovered is there's a lot of fatalists in the world. So. Other thoughts, other questions, other examples, things that work your eye. All right. Thank you very much for your time. Someone once said all good meetings start on time and end early. So I think you can see it. I will have the slides available online. Thank you very much.